This Week in Palestine offers news, history, and culture from a Palestinian perspective. The following hour may contain views that do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. Good morning, and welcome to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Sophia Rose Molman. This morning, we'll hear from two of the panelists at a recent program hosted at the Community Church of Boston, which was co-sponsored by a number of local organizations. Dr. Thaer Ahmed and Dr. Bram Whispelway will discuss on-the-ground realities in Gaza and the West Bank.
Today, we'll have a discussion on the destruction of healthcare systems in Gaza, realities and ramifications of a genocide, and actions that people can take at this time. I'd like to begin with a gratitude to Community Church of Boston for providing this space to us. And I'd like to mention all of our sponsors: Community Church of Boston, Massachusetts Peace Action, Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine, Peace and Common Security Working Group of Watertown Citizens, JVP Boston, Doctors Against Genocide, Arlington for Palestine, and Southeastern Massachusetts Coalition for a Free Palestine. First up, we'll have Dr. Thaer Ahmed. He's an emergency physician. He worked in Gaza in 2024 at Nasser and Al-Aqsa hospitals.
Thank you all very much. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here with all of you. I want to first say that it's the first day of Ramadan, so I am fasting, so I apologize for any sort of brain fog that I may be exhibiting. Usually takes a couple of days to get used to it. The second thing I want to mention is a ceasefire is supposed to expire in the next few hours, actually. And so I think this discussion is particularly relevant. I think it's important to discuss sort of what were some of the things that have been done, what does the situation look like on the ground, and sort of a pattern of behavior that we noticed over the course of 16 months, certainly not established in the last 16 months, but a system that was designed to attack life in Gaza 360 degrees. You know, there was a deliberate and intentional effort to destroy the Gaza Strip, but to destroy life in itself. So whether that's water infrastructure, whether that's schools, whether that's UNRWA, whether that's the hospital system, those are the efforts that were being made. And I think if there's any point that I really want to emphasize, it's that we have Palestinian healthcare workers and experts on the ground in Gaza, and there has also been an effort to diminish their voices, to undermine their institutions. And so any opportunity to make sure that we are listening to what they have to say, that we are relaying what they are communicating to us, and that we are insisting that they lead the effort in any sort of response or recovery, I think is your best chance at success. Otherwise, we're going to be looking at a disaster. The first thing I want to take you through is the EMT process, the emergency medical team process that was established by the World Health Organization to get into Gaza. And so we know after October 7th, the borders were sealed shut. You know, obviously, we know that the Gaza Strip after 2006, a blockade was imposed by the Israeli authorities. They cited security reasons, but really what we saw take place was that the very few opportunities to access the Gaza Strip suddenly became much more intensely blockaded. A siege was in place. Everything from food to commercial goods to humanitarian aid was inspected very heavily. First, there's really only two pedestrian crossings in the Gaza Strip, traditional pedestrian crossings that existed before October 7th. You have Rafah crossing down here, and then you have Beit Hanun or Erez crossing right over here. You see that tiny X. Yeah, there are other air accesses, but the way people were getting in and out were through those two crossings. The second thing I want you to pay attention to is the density in the Gaza Strip. Now, this is before October 7th, but what we saw after a temporary ceasefire was implemented is we saw similar movements of the populations and the density really returned. So up here, you have five different governments of the Gaza Strip. Gaza City is your most densely populated spot in Gaza. That's when they say most densely populated place on Earth. They're really referring to Gaza City, and think about it, it's more densely populated than Tokyo.
Then you've got these other main areas, Deir el-Balah, Khan Yunis, Rafah. And then you over here in the north, right, this spot right here is where you'll have
places like Jabalia, if you're familiar with hearing what was on there. So we saw after a ceasefire agreement, a temporary one was implemented, we saw more than 600 or 700,000 Palestinians return to the north, despite the infrastructure being destroyed. So again, I want to just point this picture because something that has been stripped away, and again, I think it undermines this idea of Palestinian healthcare institutions, is there's a traditional corridor that exists. The Gaza Strip, as it was making strides despite a blockade and a siege before October 7th, as it was making strides and providing care, I mean, we're really making big improvements with respect to pediatric cancer care, even cardiac catheterization, like really making some progress. The healthcare workers are doing an incredible job. There was still a decent amount of people that needed to be transferred outside of Gaza. In fact, if we look at the numbers over a three-year period, 2019 to 2021, there were 280,000 people that left the Gaza Strip to get medical care and then came back to the Gaza Strip. Where did the majority of those people go? The majority of those people stayed in Palestine. They went to East Jerusalem and the West Bank, over 50% of them. Over 50% of the people in Gaza, the Palestinians in Gaza, were being treated by Palestinians at hospitals like Al-Maqasid, which is in East Jerusalem, or Ramallah Hospital in the West Bank. After October 7th, this medical evacuation corridor has been totally shut down, deliberately by the Israelis. They don't want patients in Gaza to be able to be treated by Palestinians in other areas. And in fact, what we're seeing as a result of the ceasefire agreement, where you are having 50 cases a day being transferred out through Rafah, and I say 50, I say that, you know, I say that very generously, because we've seen some days it's 35 cases, some days it's 40 cases, some days it is 50 cases. But since January 20th, those cases are only going through Rafah, which is the Egypt Sinai that you can see there, and they're being stationed in Al Arish port, which is that city right there on the Mediterranean in Egypt. And the Egyptian system, which is already very poor to begin with, their healthcare system, is completely overwhelmed by this influx of cases that are arriving every single day. And so the natural thought, or the natural ask in this situation, is why can't we reestablish the corridor that exists? Why can't we reestablish it and allow Palestinians, who would be a lot more comfortable leaving Gaza if they were going to stay in Palestine, why can't we let them go to these hospitals? And that's still something that, as far as advocacy goes, we're trying to work hard on, and we've not made a lot of headway. I will say one other thing that's important to note. These cases of Palestinians in Gaza who are leaving for medical evacuation have to sign an informed consent that's given to them by the World Health Organization that says, once you cross the Rafah crossing, we have no control of your ability to be able to return. We cannot guarantee you the right to return, which causes a significant amount of angst, as you can imagine, anxiety, and hesitation. And we are seeing people suddenly refuse the care that they need because they're not going to separate from their families. It's already a miserable process to get a companion permit from the Israelis. Imagine suddenly telling a mother of six that this child you're going to get the medical care for, but we're not sure if you'll ever be able to return. And we have thousands of people in Egypt, stranded in Egypt, who would like to return to Gaza, who are not able to return to Gaza, which, again, any sort of plans that you hear about, forced expulsion, ethnic cleansing, I mean, these are evoking also generational trauma within people who already have been ethnically cleansed from areas in 1948 during the Nakba. So this is an important slide because I just got an update recently from the health cluster. This is before October 7th. So the World Health Organization develops a list and it says, hey, we would like each country, based on its demographics and the non-communicable diseases that are there and the communicable diseases that are present, to have these medicines in their central drug storage, in their central drug supply. And so before October 7th, this is from 2022, the West Bank at any given time had 90%. In the Gaza Strip, at any given day, when you went to their central drug storage, they would only have 55% of those drugs available. These are things like anesthetics, they're antibiotics. If there is cholera endemic to the region, which there is no cholera endemic, thank God, to Palestine, but you would require, you know, the anti-parasite or antibiotic that you would need. That's what the WHO recommends. So looking at the numbers right now, when we look at the central drug supply in Gaza during 42 days of a ceasefire agreement, we find that this number is now at 47%. And we see that we have new problems arising. Things like scabies is pretty widespread given the devastation to the water infrastructure. And so as we move forward thinking about what does the next phase of a ceasefire look like, or what does recovery and reconstruction actually look like, we want to make sure that as international NGOs start to mobilize their resources and big UN agencies start to get involved, is that they are staying cognizant of what's required on the ground. I mean, what we have in these scenarios, especially in Gaza, because of the lack of telecommunications and the really difficult ability for people on the ground to move from space to space, is we weren't getting the data that we wanted. And so what you'll see sometimes, even though there may be good intentions, is you get a mobilization of resources that aren't needed in that moment. You need other resources to be delivered. You need other things to make it inside of Gaza. For example, at Al-Aqsa Hospital, when I was there, we had a huge amount of normal saline for the IV fluids. But, you know, we needed other items. We needed medical disposables. Instead, we have a warehouse full of these items, and we don't have some of the antibiotics that we were looking for or some of the creams that we needed to treat certain skin diseases. And then this is just a brief look. Again, the notion or the term medical apartheid has existed for a very long time. And so this is what the process looked like for anybody in Gaza that was trying to leave Gaza for medical treatment before October 7th. Now, as we have seen the effects of genocide and medicide, as we're trying to refer to it, this process has become increasingly more cumbersome and more bureaucratic and very cruel, in fact, because we now have a list of at least 12,000 people in Gaza who need to be evacuated urgently, who need to get out now. If they don't get out, the thought is that they will die waiting on this list. So this whole process where you would get financial approval from the Ministry of Health, then you start submitting your documents to the Israeli authorities, and then the Israeli authorities decide if you're worthy of being granted a permit to get medical treatment. Now what we're seeing is that there are less opportunities for patients to actually be able to get out and to get out in a timely fashion. And so, again, this system and the structure that's in place has been there for a very long time. And when you are dropping 2,000-pound bombs and you're destroying hospitals and you're killing doctors and arresting doctors, it gets the system gets stressed to a way that it collapses. And so people unnecessarily die. When you have a system like that, people unnecessarily die. The mortality rate gets higher. Even for non-urgent cases, there's a higher mortality rate. So there has been, as you can imagine, there are profiteers off of war and genocide. That's just sort of the reality on the ground. But something that's particularly concerning when it came to Palestinians who were trying to exit through Egypt is the insane amount of money that was being charged per person. You know, we saw rates fluctuate from $5,000 to $15,000, depending at what stage of the genocide we were in. For a population that more than half of the population lives under the global poverty line, you're talking about life savings being spent to get a non-status in Egypt, just to be able to get away from the Israeli military, to flee an area temporarily. And these people were crossing into Egypt under these visas that, you know, wouldn't allow them to have their kids go to school, wouldn't allow them to get primary health services. This is still the case now. There's still what we think is probably 100,000 Palestinians who went out that way. This is just a comparison pre-October 7th of the life expectancy rate comparing Palestine to Israel, as well as infant and child mortality. So, you know, this is why it's important when there is an article that came out, I think about a month and a half ago, that looked at life expectancy in Gaza in 2024 and the age was 43. You know, we're really just trying to illustrate, you know, the devastation and the impact. And this is important when we're dealing with public health and when we're talking about response. You have to understand the scale of what's happening here. And fortunately for us, and I think probably what was going to obviously makes Israel look very bad, whichever way you turn it, is they are considered a country that has technological advancements, a strong healthcare system. In fact, one of their hospitals yesterday was a part of the top 10 hospitals in the world. And so for their government and their military to inflict this sort of havoc, and then they get to enjoy the right to health, it's a very clear hypocrisy that we're able to at least pinpoint. Yeah. And then this is on the side here, this is something called like an odds ratio. And the only thing is, if you were in Palestine, kilometers away from Israel, if you're in Palestine, in Gaza, or in the West Bank, and you have a heart disease, you're three times more likely to die than if you were in Israel. Same thing when it comes to a stroke or Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, this, the data is really well established here. So I wanted to bring this up because, you know, I hear a lot about the casualty count, and I think it's important to say two things. First, the Ministry of Health in Gaza is very thorough when it comes to the casualty count. And so we know it's an undercount because they insist on having the Palestinian ID number for every single person that has been killed by the Israelis. They insist on issuing a death certificate. So we are getting an undercount. And as the ceasefire extends, and as we hopefully have hope that ceasefire doesn't break down, and I hope we can get to a stage two and we can get to a permanent ceasefire, you're going to see this number drastically rise. And that's something that every public health expert will tell you. And that's something that, why, you know, when somebody tries to say something, oh, the Ministry of Health, you're taking their numbers. Well, we shouldn't take their numbers. Their numbers are very low right now, but they are, that's how methodical they are about putting together the numbers that are there. If you look at the government media office, they're including the people who are trapped beneath the rubble. But if we're being serious and we're looking at satellite imagery and we're talking about the non-direct causes, so people who died because there was a war inflicted on them by the Israelis, so people who couldn't get enough dialysis, people who couldn't get their diabetes medication, we know that number is going to exceed 150,000, 180,000. And that number is going to rise as we go through the recovery process, as we go through reconstruction. So it's important to keep in mind, like, you know, this is the very bare minimum when we're trying to understand what happened in Gaza, when we're trying to understand how many people have perished. This is just the Ministry of Health looking at people who died from a bomb or from a tank or from a drone strike. It's not taking into account the children who froze to death, the people who died because of the diarrheal illness, because of lack of a clean water, the people in the north who couldn't get dialysis, and so they died because the toxins built up in their bloodstream. So it doesn't take that into account. But those are people. And those people are no longer here, and they're no longer here because of the way the Israeli military prosecuted this campaign. Again, when we talk about trucks, first of all, not enough trucks were getting in at any point in the 16 months prior to the ceasefire agreement. And on October 6th, we know that there were 500 trucks entering, 500 trucks of food or commercial goods or tents or whatever it was, whatever humanitarian aid was entering. We never got to that level. We barely even got more than half of that until we were well into 2024. And so now when we talk about, you know, I heard Tom Fletcher, who's the head of OCHA, which is the UN Humanitarian Office. He did an interview 2 days ago with the National News, and he said in 20 days, they've been able to bring in 20,000 trucks, and mostly food items here. They're still not addressing the shelter needs, and again, we mentioned the gaps with medical supplies and medicines and medical disposables in the central drug storage. But what it should indicate to us is that there was a motivation to deprive the people of Gaza of those things. That just because we were able to get a ceasefire agreement, that means that the Israelis were intentionally starving the population because of how easy it was to continue to bring these trucks in afterwards. And I think UNRWA does a great job in their most recent situation report, just showing us how well they can operate when they're not being targeted. They lost 275 of their employees in 17 months. And the second most of the bombs stopped dropping, we saw them continue to cater to 120,000 people that were in their shelters. We saw them deliver food on a massive level. We saw them be able to get to areas of the most vulnerable Palestinians. And so that's just the food response. And so I think it's important to note that there was a clear motivation here to deprive the population of Gaza, it's the basic necessities of life. So this is another important point I wanted to bring up. This is often cited, like there are 36 hospitals in Gaza. There's 36 hospitals in Gaza. 18 are defunct, 18 are partially functioning. But really, I mean, if we want to take a look at it, some of these hospitals are, we would probably not call them hospitals here in the United States. We may call them clinics. We may call them medical centers. But there are really five or six major hospitals in Gaza that have multiple operating rooms and multiple specialists. And oftentimes you'll see these specialists moving back and forth. Nasser Hospital, where I worked at, is one of these major hospitals, and it was raided, attacked, and many of its workers were either abducted or had to go somewhere else. In fact, yesterday on Democracy Now!, there is Dr. Khaled Dasir, who spent 6 months in prison. I worked alongside him at Nasser Hospital. And somehow, heroically, this young surgeon decided to go back to the place where he was abducted, back to the place where he watched the Israeli military try to destroy. But the thought here, that what's important to recognize is, you know, we have a healthcare system that was brought to its knees by a military. And building up that capacity is going to take time. Of course, you know, when you have people like Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya, who was the Kamal Adwan director, when you have him still in prison behind bars, that's the guy that we need out. That's the person that we need leading the response. He knows how to build up a hospital, how to increase the capacity of a NICU, a newborn nursery. We don't, you know, that's as we move forward and we try to address this issue, it's important to realize that, you know, there are members of the workforce and leaders here that we really need at the table while these decisions are being made. One thing I want to say about polio is we're now trying to figure out how to mount the third phase of the vaccinations here. So there are 600,000 kids roughly in Gaza that need to get their third shot. And so, you know, this sort of issue is, I think, important to look at with respect to, you know, how do you get something successfully done like this? Sure, the WHO can call for days of tranquility and the UN can help bring in the vaccines. But what made this so successful is that Gaza's healthcare community made it a priority. And so whether they sent doctors or nurses to food kitchens or they sent them to clinics that had the roof blown off, you saw their faces there. They're the ones saying this is important, and families brought their kids out to be vaccinated. So again, any sort of campaign in the future, if you want to replicate this, some sort of success like this, yes, we want the WHO to mobilize resources. Yes, we want the UN to be able to deliver the vaccines. Cold storage needs to be preserved. But the people that you need so that the community has the buy-in, they're the ones who we have to make sure are part of any future campaign, any future response. This is just to look at, you know, as we start to combat malnutrition, you always want to think about who the most vulnerable populations are, who will be affected by this. Of course, pregnant and breastfeeding women, you think about that. You think about children who are under the age of two. So, you know, these are things that you always want to keep track of. So, again, I wanted to bring this up because I think we were all pretty shocked, maybe not shocked, but we were pretty horrified in November 2023 when Shifa was surrounded, raided the first time. And this picture is of some of the 38 kids that were in their newborn nursery in their neonatal intensive care unit. I guess I'll just kind of explain it through this story here. Despite the fact that these kids were there, the Israeli military struck the hospital, took out the solar panels, so their incubators no longer had power. And so what the healthcare workers did, actually really kind of brilliant of them, is they had some of these beds that would emit some heat from the beds, and then they would couple all of the kids together. This is really temperature control in this early stage of life is really important. And, you know, despite their efforts, during the siege of Shifa, which took place over the course of several weeks, 8 out of the 38 children died. And there was this massive effort to kind of get them transported. Again, over the course of weeks, when we were down to 30, and then 8 of them were able to, what we say, graduate. And so they were kind of reunited with their family members. And then the Red Crescent was able to transport 22 of these kids to Rafah. Now, problem is Rafah does not have, you know, they were able to bring them to Nasser. They were able to bring them to Abu Yusuf al-Najjar. The UAE has a field hospital. problem was they didn't, there wasn't really a capability of any hospital. Even my hospital in Chicago, which is one of the biggest hospitals, would struggle accepting 22 new NICU babies. I mean, that's a massive load of patients that would be brought in. So the majority of them actually were transferred out to Egypt. And the Washington Post in February, exactly 1 year ago, released a report on these kids. They followed them. And they found that there were 19 of them who have not been reunited with their parents, who have reached 1 year of age, and many of whom whose parents are believed to be dead and killed. And so one of the more tragic things is some of these kids thought that the Egyptian nurses in El Arish were their moms. This is sort of this, it's a microcosm of this massive attack on children that we saw take place. Dr. Hassan Abusetta talks about the largest cohort of child amputees. We see that, there are still many children who are on this medical evacuation list. UNICEF believes the number is 5,000 people who have been injured or need some sort of emergent surgery. And, the concern is not just the actual medical treatment that we need to provide. It's also the separation of the families, the separation from the communities, the trauma that's not being addressed. And one thing I'll say is before October 7th, there was a Save the Children report, and I can't remember what the report's name was. But it talked about trauma in children. And I know my colleagues are probably are better suited to talk about this. But the one thing I'll mention is that report had alarming levels of children who were exhibiting behaviors of kids who were dealing with trauma. Everything from bedwetting to self-harm to suicidal ideation. Insane percentage of kids in Gaza. I mean, over 40% were having suicidal ideation. And that's before October 7th. Next slide. This is just a sort of like ominous telling. If there's a ceasefire that breaks down, we know that international institutions like the WHO or like the UN have minimal ability to sort of have any sort of influence about access to care. This is just a look at January 1st through 8th, when everybody was talking about a potential ceasefire happening and the missions that they had planned for them to kind of access the north and or access other parts. And what you saw was that there is, out of these three, that there's only one that was partially facilitated. So they're getting 67% of their missions or delegations rejected. If we go back to the Israelis' full-scale ground invasion, airstrikes, our international institutions have shown for 17 months and moving forward, I don't see any change, that there's minimal intervention that they can do and that they aren't really able to have any degree of accountability. And there will be no accountability for all of the missions that have been obstructed or delayed. I mean, this is the final thing I'll say. I think part of the effort, part of the role that we can play as we move forward and talk about rebuilding a health system is combating dehumanization. And I think that's how the Israelis got away with what they got away with. And they, I hope that there can still be some degree of accountability and there can be, people brought to justice for what they did. But it's the fact that when you talk about that there were 439 kids named Ahmed that were killed, that people don't see that. They don't hear the name Ahmed. They don't think about a kid running around. All we hear is the media talk about these numbers, these abstract numbers. They'll say 45,000 Palestinians, but you never get to understand who they were. You don't get to hear the full story of Hind Rajab. You don't get to hear the phone call for 3 hours that she spent with Palestinian Red Crescent begging somebody to come and save her. And so I think, moving forward, one of the things that we can do is, when we talk about whatever this final number will be, we really make an effort to elevate who they were. I think that's the way that not only are you able to honor who the Ahmeds and Barats and Selins and Hinds and Salmas were, but that you're forcing the perpetrators of this to be confronted with their images, their names, their stories. It's easy to be able to say that this culture and this society is brought up around extremism and violence. But then when you saw hundreds of thousands of kids in Gaza go back to school 3 days ago, what you saw was their backpacks and their coloring books, and you saw their destroyed schools, and you saw teachers show up and put them in single file lines. I mean, those are the things that I think as Americans, that's part of where our responsibility is to center those stories and center those voices and to make sure that nobody forgets that Hind was on the phone asking for somebody to save her, And just like you'd think, a six-year-old who's looking at a tank 50 yards from her, that, you know, she said she was scared, and that you had to listen to an operator pray with him, say, "Hind, repeat after me, say, oh God, please help me, please save me." And I think, you know, the fact that, you know, some people heard that, but not most people heard that, I think that's where we can kind of address some of these issues. I think that's where we can make sure that we can get a permanent ceasefire, and that these are the people that we need to help with any resources possible. The last thing I'll say is, you know, there has been what I said, you know, there was a UN report that came out that talked about medicide, trying to give a definition to like medical genocide. And I think, you know, the way that the Israelis approached healthcare institutions is they violated sort of the sanctity of, you know, a hospital or a clinic or a white coat or a nurse. And I think Dr. Hussam's particular saga is truly tragic, because this is somebody who did everything that was asked of him and bent over backwards to try to keep the hospital standing and the doors open. He's somebody who wrote two New York Times op-eds, two, 1 year apart. He's somebody who the Israelis came in December of 2023, raided the hospital. They detained him, questioned him, and they let him go. So, I mean, the Israelis, you know, are they that incompetent that suddenly Dr. Hussam, in the 6 or 7 months where they held him, suddenly he became a leader in Hamas, or he's harboring terrorists? The other thing is, he had to watch his son be killed in the courtyard of the hospital. He buried his son in the courtyard of the hospital, prayed over his son's dead body. And then we watched him, after they destroyed the hospital, walk up to a tank. And the Israelis, for a long time, I think for 10 days, maybe 9 days, denied that they even had him, even though we saw images of him walking up into the tank. Denied that they even have him. It took Physicians for Human Rights Israel to actually sue, along with Al Mizan, which is a human rights group, Palestinian human rights group, to sue the Israeli government so that they can confirmed that they had him, and of course without charge. And his he was still denied a lawyer, even though they said, yes, we have him. He was denied a lawyer. He was never had, he never had any charges against him. Dr. Hussam is one of over 170 healthcare workers in Israeli dungeons right now. He's one of 170 Gazan healthcare workers that are trapped in these dungeons. And if we were to look at the reports from Human Rights Watch about what happens to Palestinians in Israeli prisons, how can we expect the people that we desperately need right now to be leading the response? How can we expect them to be any semblance of normal when they get out? I mean, Dr. Khaled Dasir went into really harrowing detail yesterday. There was a report that came out. Guardian has an article about this. And so I think, you know, again, this, we're just kind of talking about healthcare, but you can really look at this against any part of society in Gaza, the way that it's been attacked and destroyed, and the people have been either killed, tortured, assaulted. All of it is meant to sort of break the will and break the fabric of society there. And still, despite all of that, we watched 700,000 people walk back on foot to the north. And so I hope, as there's, you know, a call to something that I can ask people to do, is to sort of share, again, the stories that you're familiar with in the intimate details that you know of people like Dr. Hussam. We can get, this is a very easy thing for our elected officials to be able to sign a letter asking for his release. Very easy, Republican or Democrat. Very easy for senators and congressmen to come together and to say, Dr. Hussam needs to be released. Once they do that, we're able to build off of that and create an actual streamline of people coming out. So Dr. Hussam's release will lead to the release of others. And they know that, and we know this. And that's why this fight is so important. We really need to force their hand on that. And I think that's something that we can do. And I hope, you know, inshallah, God willing, we'll be able to do that soon.
You're listening to This Week in Palestine. This morning, we're featuring speakers from an event hosted last weekend at the Community Church of Boston. We just heard from Dr. Tha'ir Ahmed, and next, we'll hear from Dr. Bram Wispelwey of Harvard Chan School of Public Health. He's co-founder of Health for Palestine, and he recently returned from the West Bank.
So I'm going to try to, I think, compliment, you know, there's a powerful presentation. Also, what we'll hear later by talking a little bit too contextually, you know, about things before October 7th, but also looking a little bit into the West Bank, and in particular, communities organizing for health in ways that, you know, as you can see here from the title of the talk, right, are defying elimination, right? This logic of elimination that informs, right, and that there really spoke to, I think, again, in a way that was really powerful, of what's happening now in Gaza, but also marks the larger project of dispossession of the Palestinian people over many generations. And so I want to just honor one of community health workers, right? So I'll talk about this community health worker program that's working in 5 refugee camps, working out of community-based grassroots organizations, really in many ways supported by, you know, small dollar donations from committed folks around the world, including in the U.S. But Rasmi Arafat was one of our community health workers who was shot in the chest and killed in October 2023, but in Balata refugee camp in the West Bank. Beloved by his patients, by his fellow CHWs, and by all of us, was an incredible human being and health provider. This was during one of our trauma trainings from that summer of 2023. I want to also put all of this into a framework of accountability, right? Of course, we're here in the United States, right? This is not, oftentimes we'll hear the term, right, that the United States is complicit in genocide, but it's not really complicit, right? Complicity is maybe what we have, right, where some of our tax dollars are going towards genocide. But the United States is the majority partner in genocide in this case, right? 70% of the genocide has been paid for by the United States, right? So it's a little bit different than complicity in that sense, right? And so we have to think about our own accountability for those of us who are based in the United States, right? So this is the piece that we wrote in Al Jazeera in November 2023. Right, calling for this exact thing. American doctors should be doing all we can to protect, right, these healthcare workers, right? They're just, you know, told some of the stories of some of them, right, in Gaza. Why aren't we, right? And that was November 2023, right? And still, despite, you know, really heroic efforts and many things going on, including from Doctors Against Genocide, Dr. Karama, Dr. Nidal, and others, right? We still, the mainstream American medical associations, right, you know, academic, you know, medical centers, institutions are at, you know, at best silent, and at worst actively complicit in censoring and silencing and eliminating hearing from voices of our colleagues in Gaza and throughout Palestine. This is from Permission to Narrate from 1982 from Edward Said, right? Facts do not at all speak for themselves, but require socially acceptable narrative to absorb, sustain, and circulate them, right? This idea really that, you know, even when we're talking about the kind of atrocities, we need to be able to situate them responsibly in some kind of larger framework, history, philosophy, you know, so socially, et cetera, right? And that's true for health as well. So social epidemiologist Nancy Krieger says something very, very similar, which maybe I'll be able to even paraphrase. It's one thing to observe an association, right, between two variables, cause and effect in health. It's another thing to explain it. This is why theory, causal assumptions, and frameworks are key, not just the observable facts, right? So we may be able to have, you know, some agreement about certain things that have happened in terms of destruction of healthcare, but how are we going to situate that, right, into a larger story that's actually going to motivate a movement for change? I'm just going to give a little few personal details. So, you know, most of the places currently, you know, the community health worker program I'm talking about is in Tulkarm and Nur Shams camps in the north, and Balata camp also in Nablus, and two camps, Aydin Laza camps in Bethlehem. But I actually went to medical school just, you know, maybe about 20 miles from the Gaza Strip in Beersheba, which you can see on the map, and kind of went actually fairly ignorant American at that time. I was going because a partner of mine actually was working for the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel, Adala, which essentially is sort of like the NAACP of Israel. 2 weeks after I moved there in 2010, there was a village about 10 kilometers from Soroka Hospital, where I studied for 4 years, that was destroyed, was demolished, right? These were Palestinian citizens, Bedouin citizens of Israel, called Al-Rakib. Kind of was shocked to see this and sort of like, what's going on here? Got to know this community very, very well. Spent a lot of time, in particular, with two families who've continued to keep rebuilding. We used to do weekly protests every Sunday. And as you can see, I actually just had to update this with the slide on the right, just with the latest. This was, I think, from earlier this year, has been demolished now, I think, something like 235 times since. And there's two families that continue to rebuild, right? So again, this is not in Gaza, it's not in the West Bank. These are Palestinian citizens who live right outside Beersheba. This really required me to do a lot of work trying to understand how to understand this, how to explain it. And really, this gave me a lens to not only understand that Palestinians really provided to me, you know, as a white settler American, but to also understand my own context and country, right? What Mahmoud Mamdani, the Ugandan scholar, calls the world's first modern settler colonial state, right? The United States. You can see here, this comes actually from one of Mamdani's papers, right? But this was a discussion, the Knesset, right? Sort of Israel's parliament. At the time I was in medical school, right? They were arguing about what was called the Proverb Plan, about displacing tens of thousands of Palestinian Bedouin out of their villages, right? And one of the Knesset members says, hey, you want to transfer an entire population? And Miri Regev, who's the current minister of transport of the Likud-dominated government, said yes. You can see her there on the left. Yes, as the Americans did to the Indians, right? So it's this shared settler colonial logic really across time and space. So thinking about this kind of context, right, where you have, you know, what Patrick Wolf, the historian, has called, you know, the logic of native elimination. What are the health consequences that ultimately develop, right, when you have this displacement and replacement project? Because it's not just about moving people out, sequestering them into small spaces, reservations, Bantustans, the Gaza Strip itself, right, 4 miles by 24 miles, right, artificial creation, 80% refugees, right? You know, and you can see here, this goes back to a PBS documentary called Bad Sugar from 2008. The narrator is talking about diabetes, right? So we think about diabetes, right? You know, a metabolic disorder, you know, Pacific Islanders, African Americans, Aboriginal peoples in Australia, they all suffer from type 2 diabetes at rates double or triple the national averages, right? And you have this epidemiologist from Berkeley saying, and they have totally different histories, right? So he's making the point that these are not genetically connected people. They're not biologically connected. They're not culturally, you know, connected, right? Maybe across many, many oceans. But he says in all of these far-flung parts of the world, the social circumstance of being ripped from roots ends up with the same manifestation of disease, right? That's not how we're as clinicians, right? I'm an internal medicine doctor, right? We're not taught to think about a distribution of disease in this way, but actually this is what the patterns, if you sort of look at them with the right frame, will ultimately tell us. Next slide. You can see here, right, you know, again, making that comparison between the two contexts, right? We talked about, you know, Thayer showed us some data, right, on mortality from cardiovascular diseases and others, right? These are rates of diabetes, right? And you will see this too among Indigenous Australian people compared to white settlers. But you can see here, right, the two populations predominantly colonized, right, and displaced, right? In one case, kidnapped and enslaved, right, and displaced from their indigenous locations within West Africa, brought to the Americas, as well as the indigenous peoples who were themselves then displaced to make room for the plantations in which those enslaved people were made to work, right? So you can see diabetes rates, but that's not just diabetes. You'll see that across all different patterns of disease within the settler colonial United States. Similar, right, you can see here in Israel, and even within, right, when we look at Palestinian citizens, you're looking at, you know, almost double rates of diabetes. And then when you get to contexts like, for example, the population we're working with in West Bank refugee camps, dramatically higher rates. Back during COVID too, right? You know, when we knew that there was this deadly synergy, right, between COVID and chronic diseases that were happening. And as in other parts of the world, the prevalence of the disease in these West Bank camps is linked to land dispossession, structural violence, and colonial domination oppression. I showed this slide as part of a talk I was giving to actually high school students, Diné high school students, right? So in the Navajo Nation, when I was a resident working out there, and they were like, oh, you know, I was talking about Palestine, talking about the communities that I was working with, and they were like, oh, we have that exact map. I was like, okay, this would have been, you know, about 10 years ago. They're like, yeah, that's literally like, they understood immediately this story and its relationship to health, right? Right. And over this, over 300 years, as opposed to about over 100 years. And we're left with what? Spatial sequestration in reservations, right? Colonially controlled reservations, right? Not dissimilar from the situation of having refugee camps throughout occupied Palestine. And also, again, the Gaza Strip itself, right? As that sort of artificial creation, right? And in settler colonialism, I won't go into it too much here, but obviously continues to be a reality. This is from Visualizing Palestine. They do a lot of incredible work right across the globe. But also, as you can see in the dark gray, there are many cases, particularly on the African continent, where settler colonialism has been defeated, right? Or at least partially defeated. Thinking about, you know, southern Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Algeria, over a million settlers were forced to leave. I'll just mention this briefly, right? So we talked a little bit about genocide, right? The connection between settler colonialism and genocide has been discussed a lot. This is from a South African historian, talks here that among all the different forms of colonial oppression, settler colonialism is the most prone to genocidal destruction of indigenous peoples, right? So this is well known. This was from 2022. And next slide. The most famous paper in all of settler colonial studies from 2006 by this English historian named Patrick Wolf called Settler Colonialism and the Elimination of the Native, in which he's really interrogating this connection between settler colonial projects, right, like Israel, right, and the Zionist project that started in the late 19th century, as well as the United States. And what's interesting about this, if you look at the date, is, right, this is before the modern siege on the Gaza Strip, right, this is 2006. And he's saying, why even do this theorization about settler colonialism? Why even bother talking about it? He's like, we can interrupt these processes. We know that this is a marker, a risk factor for destruction of, and you know, the summary liquidation of peoples. And so in the cases where settler colonialism is intensifying, and he gives the example of Palestinians in both the West Bank and Gaza, they're at risk right here, right? As Gaza and the West Bank become less and less like Bantustans and more like reservations, or for that matter, like the Warsaw Ghetto, right? He's warning almost 20 years ago of the potential for genocide of Palestinians. This is the kind of thing that should have been seen coming, and that there would have been whatever excuse, right? Because this logic of elimination, it doesn't stop, right? It's a zero-sum game, a land-based project that does not allow for the sovereignty of the indigenous peoples at the heart of it. So when we think about health frameworks, right, we should be able to incorporate these kind of historical framings, right, in these kind of projects. Again, from Nancy Krieger, that the central question becomes who and what is responsible. We don't do that enough when we're interrogating health data, these kind of health outcomes. When we look at those inequities, right, in diabetes, right, in longevity, in lifespan, in infant mortality, in maternal mortality, whatever it might be, we're not thinking enough about who and what is ultimately responsible, right, in that accountability question. We've spent some time at we have a Palestine program for health and human rights between Birzeit University's Institute of Community and Public Health based in the West Bank and Harvard's FXB Center for Health and Human Rights on really trying to interrogate settler colonialism as a major driver of health, right, in the Palestinian context, but also generally across other contexts. You know, the term apartheid has come up, right? And what ultimately is apartheid, right? So it's a system of racial domination that includes but is not limited to things like segregation. Think about South Africa, a well-known settler colonial context, and certainly Palestine as well. But apartheid in and of itself, like a system and a structure of domination, it's very important descriptively, right? It's very important legally, because unlike settler colonialism, there's ways to challenge it at the international arena. But it doesn't still tell you the ultimate underlying why, right? Which is where settler colonialism is still useful, right? Or what Palestinians often call the ongoing Nakba. So this 1948 wasn't a one-time event. There was displacement and dispossession before that. You know, one of the largest uprisings in Palestinian history, 1936 to 1939. And then certainly all the way into the present beyond the Nakba, et cetera. And so here, as you can see, right, even among Palestinian citizens of Israel, right, because of extreme limitations on where people can live. So it's everywhere in historic Palestine where Palestinians live, they have fundamentally different sets of rights, right? This is clearly apartheid, but it's driven by this land-based project that we see in all other settler colonial contexts. And we see, right, in the current discourse around settling the Gaza Strip itself, not to mention, of course, the West Bank. These are all the reports. Certainly Palestinians actually have been using the term apartheid even since the 1950s. There's examples. But then, you know, increasing recognition among not just international organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, but also Israeli, including B'Tselem and others. Oftentimes they don't fully connect it to the settler colonial reality, but this increasing recognition of the apartheid situation. Again, this is the underlying background context. Next slide. Importantly, right, and this goes back to the Brazzaville Declaration of 1981 and a WHO organized meeting there, 45 years ago, it was stated very clearly that apartheid is not consistent with health and it's incompatible, right? These are incompatible and mutually exclusive. So the fundamental agreed upon across all organizations now that are human rights organizations context in Palestine is a situation in which health is not and well-being are not fundamentally possible, right? And Thayer gave some data also that already showed that. So like, this is the kind of thing that, again, it shouldn't take then the development into from an apartheid context into to outright genocide for us to be fundamentally as health professionals and as health communities fighting against this. So now I'm going to just transition a little bit from there. So I think especially, right, you know, certainly you have the context of the immediate needs, right, and the importance of delivering healthcare, right, in this context, right, which is heroically happening both in Gaza and the West Bank. But then also in the long run, right, we have to think about this overall geopolitical context, right? What are the ways in which simultaneously to be addressing health, but also be thinking about how to resist, right, against this settler colonial elimination? And I think particularly, right, there's a huge push right now, as I'm sure many of you know, right, there was already the outright banning of UNRWA, and a project right now of actually emptying out the refugee camps in the West Bank, right? So this is an ongoing project. And so, you know, as I believe it was Deborah Rose Byrd once said, right, in order to get in the way of settler colonialism, all the native needs to do is to stay home, right? And so many ways, I think the call to action at this point too is to find ways, right, in terms of health interventions, to think about how to simultaneously allow for remaining, right, in some cases in a displaced community like a refugee camp, but that refugee camp represents, even as a displaced community, the future enactment of the right of return, right, that will happen when Palestinians go back to their home villages, which will happen. So here are some of the camps I mentioned Health for Palestine is working in, right? These are all refugee-run community health projects. This is Aida Camp on the left and Alaza Camp on the right. It's about 5,500 and 2,500 people, respectively, in Bethlehem. Very high population density. This is actually Aida. It's a photo I took a number of years ago. You know, originally, right, there were tents, then there were cinder blocks that was established in 1950, and then sort of increasing building up, right? And there's no ability to go to expand outward. In fact, actually, a lot of Aida's land was taken by the apartheid wall. And so you see just sort of increasing, right, so extreme population density in what is already a very population dense area. And that's Balata, so 30,000, so enormous. Is Tulkarm, 21,000, and again, a very small space. Now, 90% of Tulkarm and Nur Shams camp have been ethnically cleansed just in the last few weeks. Tens of thousands of people, at least 40,000 people in the north of the West Bank, also in Jenin, have been ethnically cleansed. This is happening really right now. This would be sort of enormous, you know, sort of news story in sort of quote-unquote normal times, but has been largely ignored. Aida is also, according to a study by UC Berkeley, the most tear gas exposed population in the world. Tear gas is illegal in under the Chemical Weapons Convention, the Geneva Convention, and so you can't use it in war, but you can use it domestically, right? So predominantly settler colonies like the United States use it against black and brown peoples who are protesting, and then in Israel use it really regularly against Palestinians. So essentially everyone's been exposed. Next slide. So the problem is because of those bans, it's actually not very well understood how dangerous it is. I don't know, but it's mostly American-made tear gas. And again, very poor data, but there are probably chronic health implications that we don't fully understand, including lung diseases. And if you get, you know, trapped within, you know, a small space, which happened to, this was in Aida a few years ago, a woman died from exposure to tear gas. And then, you know, so these overall, like, you know, the underlying conditions, you know, within these refugee camps, sort of constant invasion, there are home invasions, almost nightly in many cases, usually happen around 3 a.m. This is just part of sort of the colonial project of keeping a population sort of on its toes, right? Particularly when you have a relatively small number of soldiers trying to control a large indigenous population. Many of these techniques were actually learned from during the British Mandate period, from the British's own experiences with colonized populations in India and elsewhere and going on back all the way to Ireland. So essentially, right, this community health program operates with sort of three main components. There's, of course, a biomedical focus in terms of community health workers are mostly like really brilliant young folks who are very well educated, working on diabetes, hypertension, starting now a pediatric program as well. Also focus on trauma-informed care and then political education and community mobilization. So really organizing amongst themselves across the camps during what, you know, is a period of time when you think you would probably have to scale back work. Actually, they've really expanded the work. Why? You have situations like the, you know, the UNRWA being destabilized, right? The overall situation worsening because this is all camp organized activity from within the refugee camps, they've been actually able, and the need has been to expand it. And so they actually pushed to start new projects within Tulkarm and Nur Shams during what is one of the worst times in living memory. this is kind of what it looks like. This is in an AIDA camp, what we call social accompaniment, right? It's sort of, you know, meeting people where they are in their homes, making sure they have their medications, getting them to their appointments, so making sure people have their medications organized in pillboxes, et cetera. And so community health workers can really bridge that gap and have been shown to be very effective in many contexts around the world, including now in refugee camps experiencing chronic violence. There's about 8 community health workers per camp, more or less. We've had now one community health worker was killed in Tulkarm a few months ago. She was actually responding to attacks on local residents within the camp, was killed alongside her 2 daughters by a drone, an armed drone. We've had actually really impressive diabetes outcome results. And so a reduction in hemoglobin A1C, about 1.4 compared to sort of control patients, refugee camps who don't have a community health worker. Not really surprising, right? If you think and look at other programs around the world that do this kind of work. So I mentioned this already, right? So UNRWA is still continuing as best they can, right, in the West Bank, despite being banned by Israeli parliament. But as we're seeing now, tens of thousands of people are being moved out. They've already been told that they won't be able to return. We have tanks that are now in these camps, right? And already, I think it was, you know, Hubert, when we were in Tulkarm in November, I think there had been something like 160 invasions by the military since October 7th. It was essentially once every 2 or 3 days, you know, dramatic levels of violence that they've been experiencing. You know, the community health workers have been delivering babies because, you know, there's total lockdown. People can't get to hospitals, can't get to clinics, and are on all the exits and entrances are often blocked by the military intentionally. You can see here on the right, this is from Jenin, right? And this is from 1967. So again, these histories of dispossession, displacement continue to unfold and are currently happening again right now in the West Bank, similar to what we saw in Gaza over the last year and a half. Just to again make the point that this kind of thing, you know, is not unexpected, right? This is from the chair of English at Mount Holyoke College, Iko Day, who's a scholar of settler colonialism, who mentions here, right, this is again in 2015, the illegal occupation, siege of Gaza, and ongoing construction of settlements in the West Bank is an uncanny corollary to the lead up to the 1830 Indian Removal Act, which relocated tens of thousands of people from southeastern nations east of the Mississippi. So the Chickasaw, Choctaw, Cherokee, Creek and Seminole peoples, right? And so again, she's predicting and warning that this all is looking like it's leading one place, right, to mass displacements. This was from when I was last in the West Bank in November a few months ago. And you can see, right, this is in Tulkarm camp on the left. That was a photo I took that, you know, parts of it obviously are looking increasingly what people have been calling the Gazification of the West Bank. On the right, this was a home that was demolished with an F-16, right? So they're attacking with planes and bombs in these West Bank camps, again, which has not been seen since 2002 in the Second Intifada. You can see the tarps up there, which they have to put up because there's so many drones, armed drones going through. They're actually tons of bullet holes. I'm not sure if you can see in the tarps. That's the only way they can feel even a semblance of basic security as they walk down the streets. Now, many of these homes are currently being demolished. The community health workers actually, you know, on WhatsApp are just sending videos of the demolitions that are happening now. So I think the plan and project seems to be to literally just be destroying the camp right now. This is Mohammed, one of the community health workers, also in Tulkarm, who was really heroic and actually was profiled by the New York Times somewhat surprisingly a couple weeks ago, who was trying to rescue a woman who had been shot in the head and unfortunately didn't survive. And was shot in his finger and his femoral artery. He actually almost bled out. He's still trying to learn now to walk again. We had this sort of privilege of meeting him in the hospital back in November. And, you know, is very committed to sort of returning to work despite everything. But, you know, the danger and that they're willing to face and the heroism is really, you know, incredible. And again, you know, what's happening in the West Bank and the North is unfortunately eerily similar to what's been happening in Gaza. As I mentioned, this work, we're actually currently fundraising for a pediatric and trauma-informed care. And so just wanted to put that out there as well, if you're looking for ways to support these community health workers, 1 for 3.
We are out of time. If you have any questions or you would like to support us in any way, please email us at twippodcast@gmail.com. We thank you for listening, and I would like to thank the team that works behind the scenes to make this show happen. Many thanks to Bob Funk, Mohammed Al-Ghul, Stanley Robinson, Ann Lucas, Stephen Lowe, and Lish Tran. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. We thank you for spending time with us today as we continue to work for Palestinian liberation. We'll be back next week. Peace.